And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Robert comes from the 545 group. That's his home group here. He really has grown over the time he's been here. He's helped us out in this meeting quite often. He served as chairperson and has done lots of readings and handed out the chips, always steps up to the plate when asked. And here he is. He's going to tell his story. Welcome, Robert. Everybody give him a big hand.
My name's Robert, and I'm an alcoholic. I guess it's good to be here tonight. Mixed feelings. What it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Sobriety date is 11-11-10, so a little over a year. 29 years old. Coming up on 30 in about 2 months. Been drinking, and I apologize now. There is drugs in my story, so, you know, sorry. But the first thing I ever did at age 13 was pick up a drink. I'm a product of alcoholic household. My dad's a drunk. Very productive man. Manages a family farm. About 2 hours east of here. He's got a good business. Always pays his bills. His drinking. From an early age, I didn't really know what it was, I guess. Claustrophobic. I never knew that my dad was a drunk. I just knew he drank. Where I come from, the guys work hard, they play hard, and, you know, I just thought that was how it was. You know, a man goes to work every day, he makes the money, he pays the bills, you don't bother him, he does what the hell he wants to. I learned now that that's not really how it works, you know, in healthy relationships or healthy households, I guess. The first thing I can ever really remember drinking was a hot toddy. I remember being sick, my dad's a whiskey man. I remember him sitting me up on the counter in the house he built for my mom and himself and me and my sister. I had a cough, I guess, and I remember him mixing something out of this big bottle into a little bitty pan and some lemon juice and some sugar and stirred it all up, put it on the stove, and he handed it to me. And I don't really remember anything like, much about it, except that I knew it made me feel good. I don't know if it took care of the cough, but I'm pretty sure I went to sleep shortly after. Dad was never around much. Him and my mom got a divorce when I was pretty young on. I have two grandfathers. They were real, you know, played a big role in my life growing up. My dad's mom, or my dad's dad, excuse me, who was a career master sergeant, 36 years in the Air Force, which was not a drinker. Like, he could buy a case of beer and it would go stale sitting in the fridge. He might drink one. And my mom's dad, who was 22 years retired master sergeant in the United States Army. And he drank. He drank good. And he had one chair at the dinner table. I used to always remember him getting off of work. I call these people functioning alcoholics. They weren't like me. They could drink, they could pay bills, they could manage their life and their money. But when they got home, they got sauced up good fashion. They weren't drunk during the day. Never lost any jobs because of it. But when my dad kind of split the scene, we didn't see him a lot. So I kind of took more towards my mother's side of the family. My grandpa Joe. You don't get a lot of compassion growing up with an alcoholic retired master sergeant. You know what I mean? You don't complain a lot. You eat all of your food. You pick your plate up from the table, and, you know, you kind of learn how to shut up. But he was a really good man. He was real loving. He was definitely the biggest father figure I've ever had until I got my sponsor. And thank you, Rusty. I remember being 13 years old. Always hung out with what I thought was the cool kids. They were older than me in school. I always knew from a young age, like I've sat here long enough over the last year to realize that I fit in now. Like I'm among people who are like me. Always knew I was different. Always liked to isolate from a very early age. I didn't give a damn what was going on the outside. Like I could sit in my room and be fine for hours. I'd go play in the woods by myself. I remember taking swigs off of bottles from my dad. All the cool kids were drinking, but I was really good. I'm a manipulator. I'm a liar. I blend in well. I never really drank until I was about 13 years old, but I've been doing it for like a little while, but I never really got drunk. I didn't want to. I was kind of scared of it. I remember being at a party one time, the first time, and it's St. Ives. It's like a malt liquor. It's almost like a wine cooler or something, just with a little bit more bite to it, I guess. We used to get it by the cases. And I was real good because if I waited like an hour or two, all the other kids were like power drinking. So they would get smashed. I could sneak off and pour booze out and come back and act like I was drunk. And which opened up a lot of opportunities for me. I still had my wits about me, thought that I was cool, I could handle my booze, and you know. So one night it's pouring rain outside, we're stuck in somebody's living room, and I couldn't get away. So to keep up with everybody at the same pace, I just started downing booze. And after that first one went down, I had this real warm, fuzzy feeling. And I was like, oh my God, this is what everybody's doing? This is what I've been scared of? This is awesome. You know. That's great. Give me more. And I just kept repeating that. And the drinking evolved to other things. It evolved to me drinking and smoking pot. It evolved from drinking, smoking pot to drinking, smoking pot and pills. It evolved from drinking, smoking pot and pills to powder cocaine. It evolved from drinking, smoking pot, pills to powder cocaine to crack. I'm a true addict in every sense of the words. I can't eat one Lay's potato chip. You know, I'm going to buy the store out. I buy 5-pound bags of gummy bears when I have a sweet tooth. And I eat them all in like one sitting. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's like a little bit, it's not in my vocabulary. Bud's always in here and he's always talking about me more now. And always wanted more. I was never comfortable with me. I didn't ever feel like I fit in. All the guys in my family are like Fred size. They're huge, massive men. I grew up in a real small farming town. The beefier the better, you know what I mean? And what am I, like 5'10", 165 pounds, you know? I got the attitude of a great white. And, you know, I'm in the bite-sized packet of a freaking black cat firecracker. I graduated high school, was doing a good bit of partying. I went to college, Augusta State, for about a year and a half. I did not like college. I was engaged when I made this transition coming out of high school to a very wonderful young lady. And I got drunk at a party one night and did something that kind of wrecked that. I tried school on for a little bit longer, couldn't do it. I was getting in trouble, got sent away for a little while. Long story short, came back home, had a really bad hangover after a party, and decided I saw one of those Army commercials on the TV, Be All You Can Be. And I was like, well, you know, I'm like drooling in my cornflakes, and I'm like, well, that looks cool. And I enlisted in the military. I thought I would be doing something proud, too. Both of my grandfathers retired. You know, I could stick it out. I've learned through my experience and, you know, from some wise teachings that for an alcoholic of my type and sensitive nature, the military is not a very kind environment. But I did my job well. I didn't have any disciplinary actions that were ever taken against me. I served out my service contract plus a few months. And one thing that I learned how to do in my Army besides my job is I learned how to drink. We would go out on leave after training exercises or whatever else. And I don't know if you guys have ever paid any attention to this, but around any military installation, there's a load of bars. And we would go out and get, you know, hammered starting early on in the day. I mean, all I needed was like 5 minutes in a bar and I'm done. like, you know, roast me. Like, I should probably have alcohol poisoning. And then I would always find myself in uniform, shaved, and in formation at the right time. Brain on autopilot. Then I got deployed. Spent 2 years overseas. I got out in, mid to later 2000s. Had a lot of money in the bank and was not very well at that time. I came home and I never fit in well anyway, but then after all of my military training, I've learned that, you know, it's not very easy to turn a soldier back into a civilian, and I didn't fit in well. I didn't like having to go grocery shopping. I didn't like having to pick out what I was going to wear. I didn't like that there was nobody there to tell me when to go to the bathroom, like, you know, when to do everything. I'd start thinking for myself, and that's when I learned what PTSD meant, which I know is an outside issue probably, and I started having panic attacks. But I realized something. When I was feeling like my heart was about to pop inside of my chest, I could chug about a half bottle of Jim Beam, like about a half of a handle, and it would go away. But everything else did too. I blew through all the money I had saved up, drinking, drugging, all of that good stuff. And I got myself arrested. Very small town, once again. Everybody knows everybody. My family's got a pretty decent name. And they were going to get me out of jail. And I didn't want to leave. So I had told my parents that if they didn't just let me stay there, I would make sure that I at least got to stay there for 1 year. And for those of you who don't know, who have never been on lockup, if you assault a guard, you know, it's not a good idea, like if you're planning on leaving at any time soon. So with me threatening that, they found a treatment facility for me that was called the Bridges of Hope. It was real cool. I thought it was going to be okay. They didn't lock you up at night. It's kind of like the military. It was run by, I think, an old Marine gunnery sergeant, poor guy. And you had to be up really early in the morning, big whoop. You had to be shaved, big whoop. I had to go to meetings. I didn't know anything about AA. You know, stuff you see on movies. I didn't know anything about it. I walked in and sat down to my first meeting in this place. I was supposed to be there for 6 months. The first meeting I went to, I walked in and I saw all these guys that were like coming out of prison, getting, you know, sentences reduced and all this other kind of stuff there. And this is a pretty like rough place. Like, they raise cattle, they raise hogs, you grow your own vegetables, you process all of your own meat, and you go to AA meetings. And I walked in there and sat down, and when I saw everybody, I was like, oh, Jesus, like, these people suck. Like, look at them. I didn't have anything in common. Like, I mean, nothing. I had nothing in common. I stayed there instead of 6 months. I stayed only four. And once again, I was able to talk my way out of something. So I got my family to, you know, take me. I wasn't mandated there. I got my family to get me out. I stayed sober for, I think, 2 weeks. Came home. And what's funny is, you know, we talk all this good jazz in here, like you got to change playground and playmates, and you have to change everything about your life. Well, for those of you who are new, who are just coming in, it's not bullshit. If you don't want to get high, you don't want to drink, do it. There's a lot of people in here who have been doing it for a long time, and I'm pretty sure they know what they're talking about. That's my experience. I started hanging right back out of the same. Actually, the day I got out, like the next, I went home the next day. I was, you know, I've been there just about all day long, and I jumped in the car, grabbed my mom's keys, and I drove out to the last house that I was at before I got myself arrested and started my stint at the Bridges of Hope. And it's funny because everybody that I had left was still there. They were in the same spot in the driveway. There's a cooler of beer sitting on the ground, and they're all standing around drinking and smoking pot. And I thought I was better and stronger, and, you know, that lasted a week, maybe. That cycle started up, and I heard something. I was at the Bridges of Hope. The guy who was leading it, or Mr. Williams, anytime they were inducting new people in, he would always give this little spiel. He would stand up in front of everybody in the meeting hall, and he said something along the lines of, all of you guys came in here. When you got here, you left all your problems and your disease down at the end of that driveway. This is like 2 miles back off the road. He said, well, the whole time you're here, your disease and all those problems are going to be down there doing push-ups. And it's going to be getting strong. And when you get out of here, if you're not stronger than it is, it's going to tear your ass up as soon as you get to the end of the road. Yeah, right. Whatever. Bunch of bullshit. I got my teeth kicked in numerous times. Not literally. Well, sometimes literally. Over the next few years, I just accepted it. I thought, you know what? I'm just a drunk. I'm just a drug addict. I'm never going to amount to anything. It's just who I am, but that's cool. I'm okay with being a piece of crap. It's fine. You know, I don't fit in. I'm not well. And, you know, it even says in our literature something about always like saying that, like to the active and using alcoholic, like my way of life is the only normal one. Like you guys have the problem because you're not drinking. You know, I'm fine. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. You're not right. And that was so true for me. I lost numerous houses, never formed any real relationships with anybody. I couldn't get to know you. I didn't care anything about you. I just wanted what you had, and I had like booze, money, and dope radar. If you're like 200 yards away and you got something on you that I want, I know, and I'm going to get it. And it took me to a lot of bad places. I've been to Georgia Regional more times than I care to remember. Multiple therapy, anger management, lots of different things. In 2009, I ended up kind of halfway quitting. Well, to be honest, I didn't really quit the job. I was kind of asked to leave. And this was like a change because I've never been asked to leave any position ever before. I've heard people when I was sitting in here say that they lost their addictions, took all their jobs and stuff away from them. I lost a lot of things. I lost money. I lost a house. I lost cars. I lost friends. I lost family. I never lost a job. That was how I made my money. That's how I bought what I needed. So I always made sure that I took care of work. But I was getting pretty bad off, and I couldn't take care of work anymore. And the guy asked me to leave, and that didn't go over well. And I always had this backup plan, too. Like, I've said this before, but last time Howard put me on the spot. And the French Foreign Legion. If I couldn't make it in life or work or anything else, I would go join the French Foreign Legion. Like, normal people have those thoughts, right? Everybody in here has thought about doing something crazy like that, right? You all wanted to do it. You all want to, like, just disappear and fall off the grid. I even thought being homeless and being a bum would be awesome. Like, I could do it so much better. Like, it would be cool. I'd find ways to get a little bit of money, and I'd go out in the woods. I could drink. I could do everything else, you know, because I'm not going to be, like, a, what'd you call it, Frank? Urban outdoorsman? Like, I would fall off and just, like, go deep in the woods somewhere because it's cool. And I found out one thing. Just because you have survival training and it's possible for you to accomplish this, it doesn't make it fun when it's like 20 degrees outside. It's sleeting. You have a little shelter that you made out of a tarp and some bent over trees, and you have run out of booze, you have run out of sleeping pills and other substances. Like, when I'm sober out there in those conditions, it sucks. So I ended up leaving, backtracking a little bit. I got ahead of myself. I ended up leaving and going to Athens, Georgia. When I lost that job, I took the car back to the dealership. I got my brother to pick me up and went to the bank, somewhere in this order, and I got all of my money out, and I told him my plan about, you know, going to France and joining the French Foreign Legion. And he was like, dude, you are a freaking idiot. He was like, call your sister. He was like, call our sister. I have two adopted brothers, by the way. One of them is 26, 3 years my junior, and the other one's 19, and if he lives long enough, he'll be in here. The other one, the 26-year-old, I have no idea where he came from. He, like, popped out of the womb like a 60-year-old man. You can give the kid $5 and drop him off somewhere and come back, a couple months later, and he's got, like, a penthouse and a new car and, like, a great job. Definitely not blood relation. And I don't know what happened to the other one. Maybe his mom drank too much during birth or pregnancy or something. And I have one sister that's 5 years my senior who is in no way, like, same mom, same dad. She is not one of us. I don't know how that happens. I envy her sometimes. You know, she didn't have to go through all this stuff. I went to Athens, Georgia, at her advice, and where she lives. Just graduated, went to pharmacy, or graduated high school and went to pharmacy school there, and all that good jazz, except Orlando. And came up and went to school, and I went to Athens Technical College for a year, and I already had like a year and a half under my belt, and I was doing the nursing program there. All I could take was the only job I could find when I got up there was working in a pet store. Well, for an alcoholic who was being dry, like I stayed sober for like a year, like just white knuckling it. Like, you know, I was trading it out for work, school, and exercise. So trading one addiction for another. But going to work every day in a pet store making $7.25 an hour after studying for hours on end with a bunch of 16-year-old kids and 17-year-old kids was not making for a happy Robert. Like, I can't tell you how many you're freaking out or having a bad day because you're having to move a 40-pound bag of dog food in an air-conditioned store. You know, I kind of lost my cool on that for a few minutes. I stuck it out for a while, and I was still drinking, like, every now and then. I was, like, controlled drinking, I guess. And I was good at it for a little while. Apparently, until that nice monkey on my back got all gassed up and, you know, just decided to claw my eyeballs out or something. I got here in November, so I guess October 2010, it got really bad. I got fired from the job at the pet store. Totaled the car out sober. I don't know how I did that. I should have been messed up. I was actually on my way to go pay a bill and then get messed up. And I got fired from my first job for putting my hands on another employee in the back of the store, which was not cool. The kid could have got hurt really bad, or he actually could have hurt me. I still have that, you know, 10-feet tall complex sometimes. So ended up doing the urban outdoors thing for a few days. And because I was spending, I got a house when I got up there. I was leasing a house. I found a roommate to split the rent with. He is definitely not one of us. Probably wouldn't have understood. Don't know. Didn't give him the chance. All of the rent money he was giving me and our bill money, I was spending on booze and dope. So it got to the point where I knew they were going to be, like, somebody was going to be knocking on the door soon to cut lights or something like that off again. Car's gone. So I loaded up all of my crap into a pack, and I disappeared into the woods. And I'm coming up on a part where you told me last time I was going to hell, so refrain. I'm staying in the woods for a couple days, and I was running out of money. My mom has an apartment that my grandmother and her cohabitate in. So after a couple of days in the woods, I was running low, so I went back over there and took all the wine they had out of the house, and I took all of my grandma's jewelry. And thank you, Frank, for reaffirming that. I'll see you there, buddy. Isn't that where all Marines go? I went and pawned all the jewelry, and I thought I was doing a responsible thing, though, because I took the pawn tickets and I put them underneath the driver's seat of her car so that that way they could find them. You know what I mean? I was doing a responsible thing. She could get her stuff back, you know. I even had the thought, like, I should call her and tell her just to give me the money and I'd go get it back for her. I don't think they would have done that. I ended up calling my mom when all the booze and everything else was gone one morning when I woke up. My little fires had went out. It was cold as shit. I looked like, bottom rung. Hadn't shaved in a week or two and hadn't bathed in about two or three days. And had an old field jacket on and some worn out boots. The same shit I came here with, actually, that I wore for like 2 weeks. I called my mom. It's a funny thing because I didn't realize it, but like they start to recognize our patterns after so many years of dealing with the same crap. And she knew that for a few days of me not answering my phone, something was up. So when I finally got a hold to her, she was like, "What are you doing?" And I told her, and she was like, "You know, we know what you're doing." She asked me how much money I had left. Told her there might have been a couple of bucks in the bank. The only reason that was there is because I was too far away from an ATM to go and get that money out. She wasn't allowed anyway. Cell phone bill needed to be paid. It was about to be cut off. No car. Couldn't go back to the house. They had realized that the jewelry was missing. They knew all the wine was gone. And she said, you know what, I've got a really good family, and they didn't know what to do, so for years they just kept throwing money at it. We'll get you another car. You know, don't worry about it. We'll pay your rent. Don't worry about it. Here's some money to go get food. Here's some money to go out. And that day, it just stunned me because she was like, we're not giving you any more money, and I'm not calling your dad to get any. And as pissed as I got, I can look back now and say that she probably saved my life, because if they would have gave me money, I just would have hit it harder. It wouldn't have done any good. My track record spoke for itself. I was not trustworthy. My words held no weight. Neither did I. I'm not big anyway, but I probably lost about 15 or 20 pounds. So she said, the only thing that we're willing to do is we will call, or when I get there, you can't stay with us, by the way, but when I get there, I'll put you in the car and I'll take you to a homeless shelter or something. What the hell are you talking about? I'm your son, you know, give me money. They didn't give me money. I refused the ride to the homeless shelter because I'm better than that. I'm better than you guys. Better than everybody. I ended up sitting in the bathroom with a knife in one hand and a phone in the other one. And I just sat there. And I had it seemed like a long conversation with myself, but I'm sure it was pretty brief. I wasn't very deep at that point. And I was debating, you know, just ended it all because it was too hard and I couldn't go through with it anymore. Or dialing 911. So I ended up dialing 911. Despite my request, they sent an officer and an ambulance, and they took me to St. Mary's Hospital for a couple of days in Athens. And they took me from St. Mary's Hospital to Georgia Regional. And on the ride, when the dude picked me up from St. Mary's after 2 days or however long of being there, that part of my life's kind of a blur, so I apologize if anything's weird. There was this kind of heavy set dude that was driving the van, and we were stopping in another hospital to pick somebody up, and they had given me my cell phone back. I turned it on, and I tried calling my mom, and she picked up. And they didn't want to have anything to do with me, which is understandable. I didn't have anybody else to call. I didn't want my brothers to know where I was. Very close with the one that's 26. I spent the next 15 minutes after getting upset with her on the telephone trying to bribe that dude to let me out of the van. Just let me go, dude. I don't want to go there. It's cool. I'm fine. You know what I mean? I'm good. Just let me out. Tell him I beat you up or something. And he wouldn't do it despite all of my pleas. So I ended up at Georgia Regional for a while. And they did a 72-hour observation. I ended up staying there longer because I was homeless and the people felt bad for me after being there. And they found a halfway house for me. They let me stay there longer so I didn't have to be on the streets. And they paid for a cab ride from Augusta, Georgia, all the way to here. And I was a happy resident of Peachford Communities, right on the northbound access road going up. There was a sinkhole in the middle of the living room floor that was just covered by carpet. You had to avoid. We had it marked off with chairs and stuff. I went into my room and I laid, and it's funny because it looked like somebody had came in there with tar or something all over their feet and just ground it all over the carpet that was in this place. And you got five people living in a two-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bathroom apartment. And all of them chain-smoked. And so this place is like nice, like I mean really nice. I couldn't even, like, for the 2 days until, like, when I got there and went inside the apartment, I'd even, from all the cigarette smoke that was in there, I couldn't even tell what the people I was living with looked like until, like, the next day when we went outside. And it's funny because, like, we adjust to certain things, and that allowed me, I was there for, like, 2 months, and it was bad, but it gave me what I needed, I guess. And, you know, that place was pretty rough. I know I've been in worse places. But I pretty much used it just as a place to sleep, to read a little bit in the evening, and to take a shower. I was never there. I'd gotten a sponsor pretty early on. I'd met some other good people that I didn't have to go to a labor pool. They were putting me to work. And it seemed like I kind of jumped into this thing with both feet and just got hooked up with really good people when I got here. And I think in a little under like 2 months, I hit over 120-something meetings. I was here like all day long in other clubhouses. I didn't want to go back there, which was good. It took me about 2 months to learn people's names and to start getting familiar. I left there and went to another halfway house, Hope Homes, where I met some pretty good cats. And I would have loved to have stayed, but it was too expensive. The kind of work I do is not that steady. But all these places served their purpose for me. Like, it gave me what I needed for long enough and to help sustain me. And it let me get a pretty good foundation. I had to be accountable. I had to report for meetings at certain times. I had to call in and check. You know, people were calling me all the time, checking to see where I was at. I had to pee in a cup every morning. Everybody loves being woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning to pee in a cup. But the good thing about that was that I actually started enjoying it because it was the first time in a very long time that I could actually pass a piss test. So I'm like, come on. You got another one? I left there and moved in to a house with somebody in the program. That lasted for a few months. And now I've been living in Buckhead with another guy in the program for, I guess, eight months, something like that now. When I got here, I didn't want to be honest. I still don't. Like, I still do not want to be honest. I want to lie about everything. I don't want you guys to know who I am. I don't really want you to know when I'm going through a bad time. But it's getting easier, and, like, sometimes I get in my little moods where I divulge too much information. So, like, I'm trying to find, like, my sponsor says all the time, the only time I see the center of the road is when I'm switching ditches. So, you know, that's usually me swerving all over the place. And I felt alone, and everybody sitting in this room, I'm sure, got here because we're kind of maladjusted, you know what I mean? Like, we don't handle things well. We've all got trauma in our past, some of us worse than others. Trust is still a weird thing for me. The higher power concept, I didn't really grasp that one. Surrender to win kind of mentality, definitely didn't get that one. You know, fight. You know, you want me to give up, kill me. And I was killing myself. I will throw myself the worst beating better than anybody in this room could ever do it. I was actually kind of hoping I'd get up here and cry or something tonight because I hadn't had one of those in a long time. Like, seriously, like a pressure release valve or something. Like, I don't know if you've ever had panic attacks before, but, like, it sucks, that knot balling up in your chest. My sponsor is the biggest fire extinguisher. I freak out over everything, man. Everything. I was talking about 5-pound bags of gummy bears. I'm done. I don't have any more. Not wanting to go to meetings. Somebody looked at me the wrong way. I'm a kid. I'm a 29-year-old infant. And I will show my ass just as quick as you can blink. And blame it on you. Um, This has been a very odd experience. I've met a lot of good friends in here, made a lot of good friends in here, some of which I hope they're always in my life, some of which, wake up in the morning and wish I couldn't remember. So the other thing that I've noticed about being an addict and an alcoholic, I don't know if you guys can relate to this, but I remember everything, like everything. And all those memories will kill me. Like, I will literally let stuff pile up and pile up and pile up and pile up and pile up. Working through the steps, man, I purposely wanted to lie. Like, I knew I was making a conscious effort to lie on my four step when I went, because I was looking at them and they were like, all right, made a list of all persons, oh my God, I'm having a brain fart, excuse me. Made a searching, fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Well, the one right under that says, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And when I found out, I was going to tell that to my sponsor. I was like, oh, shit. He can't know that. I wasn't too much worried. I can't stress enough, if there's anybody in here who's new or not new or whatever, but you're struggling with that God thing, you're not the only one, I assure you. My sponsor's taking me back to 2 and 3. I can't tell you how many times. I just couldn't grasp the idea of turning my life and the way that I feel and the circumstances of my life over to something that I couldn't see. Like God the Father, somebody called defects. Dude's negligent. I couldn't grasp that. Like, what does he do? Does he give me work? Does he put money in my pocket? Does he buy food? Does he pay my bills? If I got a cavity, is he going to pay for my dentist appointment? Is he going to let the dumbasses at the VA, treat me better if I go? Fear. All of my life, I've operated off of fear, and I'm scared to death of everything, and that includes God, or my idea of a God. I want to be in control so bad that I will screw everything up. And then my sponsor came at me with, Robert, sometimes the hardest thing you have to do is nothing. Sometimes I just got to sit in it. Sometimes I have to feel it. I don't like feeling things. I don't like being scared. I don't like being sad. I don't like being happy because I know it's not going to last. I don't like any of it. Life and all the people involved in it are highly annoying. Everybody in this room pisses me off. But one thing that I can say is that I didn't even want to do this today. Like, I didn't want to come up here and tell my story. I really did not. And I've done it one time already. I got booby-trapped. Howard's not in here anymore. And I didn't even think about this until yesterday. And then I was like, man, I got to tell my story tomorrow. And I called Rusty, just bitching. Like, dude, I don't want to do it. And he was like, you got to be able to do this under all conditions, Robert. I love him to death. I had this weird illusion or idea that everything was going to be cool when I got sober. Like, the sky's just going to light up. My life's going to get so much easier. Certain parts of it have, but it's still a bitch. It's still life. I still have to go to work. I still have bills that need to be paid. And the funny thing is, I'm pretty sure I ate yesterday, but when I woke up today, I was hungry again. I got to buy food. If I live somewhere, somebody's going to want me to pay rent. I don't know why. It's just how it is. If they only knew who I was. If I only knew who I was. This last year has been all about figuring out who I am. Once that obsession was gone, it was me figuring out who Robert was and how I was supposed to live. I don't know anything. I have to re-educate every area of my life because I freak out over everything. I don't know how to do things responsibly. I'm not an adult all the time. And one thing else somebody said that really struck a chord in me was, unless any of us set out when we picked up that first drink to qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous, then this is plan B, and I've been having to learn how to deal with that. It's not been real easy. A lot of it hadn't been fun. The last 3 days of my life have been foobar, man. Work, relationships, like everything is a ton of work. It is so much work. And I'm not strong enough. And I say it every day. I'm like, all right, I'm done. I don't have any more willingness. I can't do this anymore. I was just telling this to somebody before the meeting. Like, I can't go any further. I'm done. I'm tapped out. I have nothing else. And usually somebody will call. Or I'll find myself getting up and taking a shower. Or, you know, just... This isn't a program for people who, in my experience, it wasn't a program for me because I needed it. Anybody who could look at me when I got here could tell that I needed it. It's not a program because I wanted it. Just because you want something don't mean you're going to get it. It's like everything else. You got to kind of work towards it. And I slack off, and I get the consequences for it. You know? It's like everything else. The output on this thing is, you know, completely dependent upon my input. So, you know, if I want half measures, then, you know, I'm probably putting... If I'm getting half measures, I'm probably putting it in half-assed. We're getting ready to close out, but I'll just shut up with saying this. You know, somebody at... I go to Biscayne a lot, and there's a guy there that I did not like a whole hell of a lot when I first met him. And I'm not going to divulge his name or anything, but it turns out he's a pretty good guy, and what ended up getting me to that point and seeing past all the bullshit is how he used to always end his shares, and he would always say something along the lines of, this hasn't been an easy way of life, but it sure has been a better way. Good night. Yeah.